The World Travel and Dining Guide with Chef Michael Glotz is now on the air. Chef Michael is a lifetime chef, CIA graduate, restaurateur, world traveler, and radio TV host. Sit back, relax, and listen to Chef Michael take you on a journey to great restaurants and travel destinations and some super culinary tips. And now, here is Chef Michael Glotz.
Hello, you're listening to World Travel and Dining with Chef Michael Glotz on the World Travel and Dining Channel. Culinary destinations around the globe and around the corner, as well as some cooking and entertainment tips, too. Thanks for joining me. Please reach out. I'd love to hear from you. The email is chefmichael@foodspacemedia.com. Remember to tell me where you live and how you listen to the show. Today we're going to Vermont. Why not? It's summertime, New England. The weather is perfect. I had the pleasure of living in Vermont a few years ago. It's just idyllic. Just get in the car and go. Or if you're not in the Vermont area, fly into a nearby airport. I would suggest even Hartford, Springfield or something, and rent a car and just drive. Vermont is the kind of state that you sort of want to drive into, especially this time of year. It's just so beautiful. Everything's in bloom. Everything's green. The mountains, the streams are flowing. It really is kind of a perfect place for a little summer getaway. Whether you've just got a night or two or you've got a whole week or so, it's definitely the place to go. Think about hiking, river rafting, kayaking, just walking. I don't do any of that stuff, but walking. Just beautiful little villages and shops and towns. Every time you turn a corner, come to an intersection, you've got this great little, you know, little village, and there's little restaurants or pubs or bars and always some little gift shopping things to do. And just get in your car and drive another 20 minutes another direction, you'll find something else. It's really fabulous. There's several different places you can go for information that's really easy. Vermont is really all about tourism. I think tourism and cheese. They make, as far as I'm concerned, some of the best cheese in the U.S., artisan cheeses. And so really, it's about cheese and it's about good time, and they kind of go together. But you can look at, go on the internet and look up VermontVacation.com. It's a great site. They've got lots of great ideas there, whether you're looking for a couple days of just getting away, maybe an afternoon day trip, or you know, you're looking to spend a week someplace different. It's a great site. They've got a little something for everybody there. Also, if you go on the internet to vermont.org/visitors, there too, listings of restaurants and attractions and farms that accept visitors and all sorts of other places to go and things to see. Really great websites. They've really, really done a great job with this. And for places to stay, I have found a couple of different sites that I really enjoy, and found a couple of places actually really wonderful things. One would be vermontinns.com. Now, when I think Vermont, I think country, and who wants to stay in a hotel or a chain something? You know, think about staying in a nice country inn, because that's kind of what New England is all about. Big, beautiful homes. You know, your room is not just going to be a cookie cutter room with the same furniture as the next, but oftentimes these inns, every room is different. They're oftentimes filled with antiques, beautiful views out the window, just really fabulous. And there's a couple of great inns on there that I have found, as well as another site called Distinctive Inns of New England, and that would be at distinctiveinns.com. So there's a few great places. One of my favorite towns in Vermont is Grafton Village, home of Grafton Cheese and also home of the Grafton Inn. And you can find them at graftoninvermont.com. This is for folks that are looking for something a little bit larger. They want people around, great restaurants and so on. I think they have about 45 assorted rooms and suites and even some little guest houses. Two great restaurants, one sort of a little more formal called the Old Tavern and another called Phelps Barn Pub, where you can get more casual food, perhaps taste some local beers, some Vermont beers. What I really like about the restaurants in Vermont is that they really focus on Vermont cuisine. I think it's really where sort of the farm-to-table thing really, really started. There's so many great farms in Vermont. It's not just about cheese, but about wonderful produce, too. Another great inn, if you're looking for something a little bit smaller than 45 rooms, there's one in northern Vermont, actually in a town called Lower Waterford, and it's called the Rabbit Hill Inn. I just love the name. Who doesn't want to stay in a place called the Rabbit Hill Inn? And you'll find them at rabbithillinn.com. They're a little bit smaller, 19 rooms. Most of the rooms have fireplaces. just beautiful countryside. They've got a great restaurant there that they sort of bill as modern American cuisine. And again, in looking at their menu, I see words like Vermont-raised pork, local cheese plates. I mean, this is what you want. This is when you go to a place like Vermont, don't eat in chain restaurants, don't eat in cookie-cutter places. Go and search out these beautiful inns. They oftentimes have fabulous restaurants. Or if it's more of a bed and breakfast, they can tell you where the fabulous restaurants are. And support the chefs, because the chefs support the farmers. There's a great thing going on in Vermont called the Vermont Fresh Network. And what this is it's a network of chefs and farmers and food artisans and diners. And anyone can participate in the Vermont Fresh Network. When I had a small restaurant in Vermont, I was a member of the Vermont Fresh Network as a restaurant. You, as just a consumer, can go to vermontfresh.net. That's vermontfresh.net. And sort of look at restaurants in the region of Vermont where you're going and see who's participating in the network. What does that mean? That means they really support local farmers. They're buying a lot of produce from local farms. There's small butchers as well in Vermont where there you can get locally raised lamb and pork and beef, chickens, all sorts of birds, quails, and of course cheese. When I think Vermont, man, I think cheese. Because it's the cheese, it's the artisan cheese capital of the United States. They might not produce the largest volume of cheese in the U.S., but as far as I'm concerned, as this chef is concerned, they produce the best. I could make a week in Vermont just by sort of driving over the border and stopping soon, like in Wilmington, just over the border, and camping out for the night, getting up in the morning, and going on a cheese journey. And you can go to the Vermont Cheese Council online and see all of their member farms, and you can sort of take a driving tour of the Vermont cheese industry and really take your time. It's really a lot of fun. A lot of cheese makers accept guests, and if they don't, if you call them in advance and sort of set up a tour in advance, they probably receive you very nicely and sample you on their cheeses. But some of them do have sort of tours that they give and little gift shops where they sell their cheese and cheese paraphernalia. And you could really just make a whole vacation out of visiting all of the... I'm getting myself excited here because I'm thinking I need to do that very soon. Just go on a cheese trip right through the mountains of Vermont. It's so beautiful. Every corner you take on the road, there's just another mountain, another beautiful sight. And you look and you say, wow, that's just really beautiful. And you go around the bend and it opens up to another beautiful vista. And that's what Vermont's all about. We think of Vermont so much as probably one of the skiing destinations in the U.S. But this guy, I love it for the summertime. I love it for the great restaurants, the great farms, the great cheese. And, you know, you can still get a cool night up there, build a little fireplace in your little guest room at one of these great inns, and wake up in the morning and go downstairs to the smell of fresh food cooking, bacon on the grill, sausages, and, of course, Vermont maple syrup, because I can pour Vermont maple syrup over everything. So there you go. Go to vermontvacation.com or vermont.org/visitors. For some great tourism information on Vermont. For places to stay, you might want to visit distinctiveinns.com. That's the website of Distinctive Inns of New England, where they list all, not just Vermont, but many places in New England in general. But there's some great Vermont contacts there as well. Another great place is the Historic Hotels of America website, and you'll find them at historichotels.org. Another great spot to find places to stay. Don't forget about the Vermont Fresh Network, vermontfresh.net. Find out what restaurants are using what farms. And I find, too, that when you go, when I travel to places, I like to meet chefs and meet people in the restaurants, and they can also give you great ideas of where to go. You had a particular great meal in the restaurant. You love the cheese. You love the lamb dish or something. If you chat with the restaurateur about it, oftentimes they can tell you who to go visit to find that lamb or to see that cheese being made, or a great little farm or a little village. So don't be afraid to ask. That's some of your best resources. Sometimes we have to close our computers and get off the internet and just talk to people and find about great places to go. You're listening to the Travel and Dining show with Chef Michael Glotz on the World Travel and Dining Channel on Global American Broadcasting, streaming 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. on Saturday mornings on the GAB1 app on your mobile device. Have a cooking or entertaining question? I'd love to hear from you. Email Chef Michael at foodspacemedia.com. welcome. You're listening to World Travel and Dining with Chef Michael Glotz on the World Travel and Dining channel. Hey, folks, have a great food destination you want to share with your fellow listeners? Tell me all about it. You may be the next radio guest. The email is chefmichael@foodspacemedia.com. Let's talk about two wines that some folks find confusing because they have such similar names, and really the two wines couldn't be any different. I'm talking about Puy Fossé and Puy Fumé. These are two wines from France, two of the great white wines from France. They're very different in styles, use very different grapes. These are what's called AOC wines, and you'll see that on wine labels, that stamp or that little symbol, AOC. What does that mean? In French, that means Appellation d'Origine Contrôlée, in my bad French. And basically what that means is they're protected names. You can't have a Puy Fossé that comes from California. You can't have a Puy Fumé that comes from the Burgundy region, right? They're protected names in locations. Puy Fumé has to come from Puy Fumé, has to come from the Puy in Loire. And Puy Fossé comes from Burgundy. And it always has to be that way. Let's tell you a little bit about these two wines. Wines in the old world are often referred to by their location as opposed to their varietal. And this is the perfect example. Okay, Puy Fossé in the United States, we'd call it Chardonnay, right? Puy Fossé is where it comes from in France. Chardonnay here in the U.S. could kind of come from anywhere, and then on the label we'll say Sonoma Valley, or, you know, we'll put the Appellation on the label. So it's a little confusing in that way. So when we look at French wines or any wines from the old world, oftentimes they're labeled by their location. So Puy is the name of two very different towns in two very different wine-growing regions. So now Puy Fossé is part of the Mâconnais, which is in southern Burgundy. It's sort of in the west-central area of France. And Puy Fossé is always 100% Chardonnay. Has to be, okay? The other wine, Puy Fumé, is from the far eastern end of the Loire Valley, and pretty much almost in the center of the country of France. And it's on one side of the Loire River. And, of course, on the other side is Sancerre. And Sancerre is perhaps the world's most highly regarded region for Sauvignon Blanc. And of course, Puy Fumé is 100% Sauvignon Blanc. Okay, so now we know that Puy Fumé, Sauvignon Blanc from the Loire region, Puy Fossé, Chardonnay from the Burgundy region. And hopefully through the rest of the show, I won't twist my tongue and confuse you even more. It's really pretty easy once you kind of get it going a little bit. So Puy Fossé is classic, no-nonsense Burgundian Chardonnay. It really is. Tends to be a little bit oaky, but has really elegant overtones. To me, for the chef, it's a wine that needs food. It's something I want to pair, okay? And on average, these wines from the Mâcon region are a little bit more affordable than their neighbors in the Côte de Beaune, right, where we've got some of the more expensive French Chardonnay. So drinking Puy Fossé is a great way to experience French Chardonnay without necessarily the price tag. Puy Fumé is stainless steel aged. We're going to the Sauvignon Blanc grape here, stainless steel aged. It's really a little bit more about the grape varietal, whereas Puy Fossé, the Chardonnay, is traditionally oak aged and imparts a little bit of that flavor into the wine. So already you're learning a little bit different regions: Puy Fumé, Sauvignon Blanc, Loire, stainless steel aged, Puy Fossé, Chardonnay, Mâcon, wood-aged. If you're just joining me, you're listening to World Travel and Dining with Chef Michael Glotz on the World Travel and Dining channel on the Global American Broadcasting Network. One of the many ways you can listen is Saturday mornings from 7 to 9 a.m. on the web. Go to Gab Satellite. That's gabsatellite.com. So let's get back to the wine here a little bit. If you would compare these two wines side by side, you've got a glass of Puy Fumé in one hand, a glass of Puy Fossé in the other hand, and you're sort of looking at them and evaluating them and smelling them before you taste, you would notice that the Puy Fossé is probably a little bit more golden. Now, assuming these two wines are of the same vintage, the Puy Fossé would probably be a bit more golden in color, and that would come from the natural color of the Chardonnay juice, along with a little bit of wood aging, right, because those wines are sometimes fermented and always aged in wood, whereas the Puy Fumé would be a little bit greener, maybe a little bit lighter in color. So right away, you can see the differences in the two wines. It's one of the things that us wine geeks look at when we're evaluating wines. Color is a big part of it. So with the nose, which is what you smell, it's sort of the aromas, right? You swirl the wine, you put your nose in the glass, right? And you sort of you breathe in and you sort of what am I smelling? And we use all these different wine terms to describe what we're smelling. And oftentimes they're terms that aren't really food related. But in the case of these two wines, generally speaking, Puy Fossé is going to smell like apples and melons and ripe peaches and a little nutty. Puy Fossé also has that wonderful sort of richer, a little bit heavier aromas. Puy Fumé, on the other hand, is a little bit more earthy in its aromas. You can smell some sort of vegetable herbs and green vegetables. You smell things like white flowers sometimes, tart fruits like grapefruits or other citrus. It's classic Sauvignon Blanc grape, but Puy Fumé also has that very sort of smoky gunflint aroma that's its trademark that comes mostly from the limestone soils that the Sauvignon Blanc grape is grown in. In the mouth, once you swallow it, because first you're going to now remember with wine, you're going to swirl a little bit. You've analyzed the colors a little bit as we've just talked. You're going to notice how quick the legs run down the side of the glass, right? The Puy Fossé, a little bit heavier wine perhaps. Legs are going to take a little bit longer to run down the side of the glass, whereas the Puy Fumé, a little bit lighter. The legs will run a little quicker. That tells you a little bit about the body of the wine too, right, and what you might want to pair it with. So in the mouth, once you get the wine in, the Puy Fossé you're going to find is a little bit heavier, maybe a little richer, straightforward, but complex. All right, this is a wine that's really great with like briny shellfish or hearty preparations of white meat. Think creamy fish stews. Think roasted chicken with herbs, roast pork. I do a classic sort of Puerto Rican style roast pork leg that's known in the islands as pernil, and it's just pork covered in garlic and herbs and seasonings, and I slow roast on the grill for about 4 or 5 hours, and I'm sort of thinking that this Puy Fossé would be perfect with that pork dish. Puy Fumé, on the other hand, has got that typically zingy sort of Sauvignon Blanc fruitiness about it. Little tinges of sort of flinty minerality, again from the limestone, a little bit more acidic and crisper than the Fossé, and you get a little bit of smokiness as well. This is a wine that's great for just plain old sipping. Let's start there. Just a cold bottle in the refrigerator, just to kind of cool you off on a summer afternoon. Friends over, an aperitif just before dinner. And if I'm going to pair this wine with food, I'm going to think about it can go well with, think of buttery, rich, creamy sauces and things, because the tart acidity of this wine will cut right through the rich sauces. So I'm thinking about grilled fish that maybe I've done a nice butter or cream sauce with, maybe some herbs in that sauce. Something like scallops. Maybe I've grilled the scallops and I'm doing them over some buttered noodles with a little squeeze of fresh lemon, right? The tart acidity of the Fumé is going to cut right through the richness of the scallops, right through the butter, right through the cream, blend in with the lemoniness of the sauce a little bit. It's going to be perfect. Or simple preparations of white meat dishes, simple veal stews, maybe a great chicken pot pie. I get myself hungry sitting here talking on the radio sometime. I have to leave the station and go out and get lunch. But just different. Think about lighter fare, right? It really, wine goes with anything you want it to go with, because that's what's really important. Enjoy it with what you enjoy it with. There's no real hard, fast rules, just what sort of tastes good to you. Fumé Blanc, by the way, Puy Fumé, is a term in this country. We know Fumé Blanc from California. It's the Sauvignon Blanc grape. It's the same grape that comes in Puy Fumé. Here's a really interesting note. Back in the 60s, everyone was drinking Puy Fumé, which was also known as, of course, Blanc Fumé and Sancerre. Robert Parker changed the name to his wine in California from Sauvignon Blanc to Fumé Blanc, and that's how we know it today. Delicious wine. If you're just joining me, you're listening to World Travel and Dining with Chef Michael Glotz on the World Travel and Dining channel. Want to be my next guest? Send an email to chefmichael@foodspacemedia.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome. You're listening to Culinary Destinations with Chef Michael on the World Travel and Dining Channel on the Global American Broadcasting Network. Our destination, a very cool cafe in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida. I'm talking about the Culinary Cafe. On the web, you'll find them at culinarycafe.com. But for now, listen up right here, because I have chef owner Tim Lippman on the line. Hello, chef.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. How are you today? How's everything in Palm Beach Gardens?
Everything's good. It's a little warm, but, you know, we're doing good. Good lunch today.
Excellent. Great. And good lunch the other day when I was there. Just love your food. Absolutely love your food.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule today to join us. I know what the restaurant business is all about, and trying to eke out 10 minutes here or there can be challenging.
Yeah, absolutely, it can.
Sure, and I know from being there that you're a chef operator. You're on the line. You're back there with the guys, and you're teaching and you're training. And I just marveled watching you the other day. You're so hands-on with your staff. I think that's so important.
Well, you know, we really feel that that's kind of the heart of it. It's like, you know, growing up in this industry, it's really that's what makes us who we are as chefs. We strive to, you know, pass on anything that you can. You know, growing up, you want to learn as much as you can. And as you get a little bit older and you get into a different role, you want to teach as much as you can as well.
Sure. I think education is such a great part of our industry. And we're, you know, we educate those who will follow in our footsteps and become great chefs behind us. And we also have an opportunity to educate our customers and turn them on to new flavors and that sort of thing, which you do very well. You know, your restaurant facade is very unassuming there in the parking lot in Palm Beach Gardens. But when you walk inside, I mean, to me, the Culinary Cafe is a foodie haven. Like, I feel like when I'm there, I feel like everybody sitting around me, they must be chefs or other restaurant owners. You know, it's that kind of a place, like a neighborhood bar, except all of the patrons are chefs.
You know, we do actually get a lot of industry people here. And, you know, we welcome that. It's a great opportunity to, you know, reach out to them and chat with them and talk with them you know, strengthen our relationships that we have in the community with the other restaurants, with the other chefs around here. You know, we all work together. We kind of speak the same lingo. And, you know, from your experience, there's kind of, you know, that bond between another restaurant person, even front of the house or back of the house. It's always strong. And it's a lot of fun to sit down and talk with somebody.
Absolutely. I think we have different blood than the rest of the people on the earth, right? Don't we?
You know what? You kind of got to put you up with to. What you do in this industry. It takes a special person, and you know, you got to love it. That's for sure.
Absolutely. One of the things I love about your food is that it's so there's no nonsense about it. It's very authentic, and it delivers the punch that the menu promises. Which oftentimes, you know, there's chefs that are great menu writers. And then they can't deliver. And then there's chefs that really deliver, and sort of the menu's a little understated. And I'd put you on that second half of the burner, because I think that your food, I get so excited when I read your menu, because I know the food is going to taste even better than the menu reads.
Well, you know, you never want to leave somebody to be disappointed in the end. But, you know, that being said, in my experience, I always want to kind of leave that menu and not hoping for, you know, them not to, I don't want to leave them looking for more,
right.
But I definitely don't want to confuse them too much with all of this, you know, chef jargon and lingo that's kind of going on, and you end up having a book of a menu. We just like to kind of state what's going on with the dish very simply, what kind of dishes, you know, what kind of ingredients we're putting into the dish, and then kind of let the food itself speak for, you know, speak on its own.
Yes.
You know, and I've always said to my guys, is like, we only have one purpose here. Our purpose is to cook good food.
Yep.
And that's what it comes down to. You know, you talk about, you know, walking in and a little bit unassuming and stuff like that. You know, this is about people getting away, and that's what our industry is about. You never know what somebody might have experienced before they walked in the door. So what you're here to do is to make them a good meal. Maybe it could bring back a memory. It just kind of takes them to a different place.
Right. Maybe you'll create
really
some new memories. Sure.
Absolutely.
Every time I've been, it's created new memories for me. And I go back to the memory of that burger, which I'm sort of a burger guy. I can appreciate a really great 5-star meal, and then I can appreciate of just an awesome hamburger. And if I say I've had three great hamburgers in my life that I could talk about, you're one of those three. Because tell us about your burger. It's just really, it's kind of a signature that you do.
Yeah, absolutely. That's awesome how much you love it, too. I tell you what, I had a half of a burger for lunch today. I split it with one of my guys. So what we use is Creechstone Farms beef out of Kansas. I've been great friends with these guys for a really long time. They do a great job in their process. They're very responsible in terms of how they operate. So we take the brisket, the chuck, and the short rib off of the animal, and we grind it into a special grind that we develop and that really kind of suits our taste in terms of what it is that we want to accomplish in terms of that meat flavor, in terms of the fat content. And then from there, we use fresh bread that we get from local bakery here, Importico's Bread. They do a great job over there. It's a nice, fluffy, and eggy challah roll. Mm-hmm. Slap the burger on that. We make homemade pickles, homemade ketchup, homemade mayo. And with that, we also use a nice stone-ground mustard. If I could make a mustard this good, yeah, I would probably do it. But this mustard is just so good, I just kind of leave it as is.
Sure.
Lettuce, tomato, onion. And then, you know, we really kind of load it up. Whatever you guys want, we can do bacon, cheese.
My favorite is the farm egg. Just doing a sunny up farm egg on top. I love that.
Yep.
I
learned that from some Latin friends of mine, and they put eggs on their burgers down in South America. They used to get it, all over the place. And I was like, you know what, that's a great idea. And we started playing with it a couple years back. And when we came here, my wife was like, you got to put the egg on there.
Absolutely.
So if you notice on our menu, you can add an egg to anything.
Absolutely.
It's a side dish.
I had the pleasure of living in Puerto Rico for the majority of my adult life, and they have a tradition down there also that they call acaballo, which sort of literally almost sort of means on horseback. How that got to be about an egg, I have no idea, but they serve a sunny up egg on just about anything you want it on, which is just really fabulous. And so that's the first time I've had it, but I certainly, when I have your burger, I put that egg on top. It's really great. On a most recent visit, I enjoyed some really awesome lamb meatballs with sort of a barley risotto. That was really fabulous.
Yeah, so the lamb, we use Neiman Ranch, and we grind everything in-house. It's part of what we do. We really like to keep everything hands-on, like you said in the beginning. As much as we can do, we do it here. So we grind everything here. We make the lamb meatballs. We use a leg of lamb from Neiman. And from there, we make the meatballs, and then we grill them. And it gives it a great little kind of crunchy exterior with a little smokiness at the same time. And then we like to use barley in our risottos. Not all of them. We'll use different grain time to time. But the barley works really well for a couple of reasons. One, being here in South Florida, it's always hot.
Sure.
So it really lightens up the dish quite a bit. And it allows you to eat it and not be, overstuffed, not to have that nice big brick in your belly.
Right.
But then it also maintains such a great chewy texture with a good bounce to it.
That's what
I really like.
Yeah, the mouthfeel of the barley is phenomenal. Of course, I was there for lunch, and you're absolutely right. You know, the idea of sitting down and eating a bowl of risotto for lunch, while it's exciting, it was even more exciting to finish that bowl of risotto and not feel that the weightiness just because it was the barley. Really fabulous.
Yeah, yeah. And you know what? That's part of it. Cooking with textures, cooking with flavors. It's all got to be, it's all got to work together.
And
right?
Cooking with love. Quick before we go, because we're running out of time, I have to mention something to our listeners that I read on one of your websites or in an interview about you somewhere as I was getting ready for today. And it said that chefs can leave their bag of molecular tricks at the door, that you're a little bit more old school in that way. And kudos to you for that, because I think that you put it on the plate. And you can leave the chemistry lab at home. Just keep doing what you do, Chef.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Great. So you can find them on the net at culinarycafe.com. Also, go to their Facebook page. It's Facebook.com/ Culinary Cafe. And also follow them on Twitter at Culinary Cafe. They do a daily menu that you'll find there. So you'll see all the different specials and things they have going on. It's really great. Thanks for listening to Culinary Destinations with Chef Michael on the World Travel and Dining Channel here on the Global American Broadcasting Network. Want to hear more? Listen every Saturday morning from 7 to 9 a.m. Download the Gab1 app on your mobile device today. listening to The World Travel and Dining with Chef Michael Glotz on the World Travel and Dining Network on the Global American Broadcasting Network. Streaming live 7 to 9 a.m. on Saturday mornings on the GAB1 app on your mobile device. If you've got a cooking or entertaining question I want to hear from you, email Chef Michael at foodspacemedia.com. Remember to tell me where you live and how you hear the show. It's summertime, and I think picnics. I think backyard barbecues. I think packing up a cooler and going to the beach. I think about inviting friends to come on over and hang out by the pool for the day. It's the perfect time to entertain outside. And so if your guests are going to be outside and everybody's going to be outside having fun, you want to also. So it's important to think about your menu in advance. And I always think about taking food to the beach. And if you start that way, any picnic you plan in your mind, plan it as if you're going to the beach. Because if you're going to the beach, you don't have an opportunity to cook, right? You've got to have everything sort of together and ready to go. Use that same technique when you're entertaining at home during the day for a nice outdoor gathering. Don't leave last-minute things that you have to cook and finish in the oven or in a sauté pan, because you're going to find you're spending your beautiful summer afternoon in the kitchen when you really want to spend it out on the back deck with the guests. I like to keep my food for summertime entertaining cold, because that way it really allows me maximum time with my guests. I can put a lot of energy into the food before people arrive. Maybe you don't have guests. Maybe it's just the family, right? You want to sit outside with them at the picnic table or by the pool and enjoy also, right? Don't leave yourself in the kitchen. So plan on no cooking, just maybe some last-minute touches, some last-minute plating. So, of course, the first word that comes to mind is salad. What is a salad? That's a really interesting question. And as a chef, I asked myself that question before the show today, and I really couldn't define what a salad is. Because right away, your mind goes towards greens, right? Leafy greens with a little oil and vinegar dressing, and maybe you throw a few veggies in there. True. But a salad, I've already told you on the show here that I like to grill my salads. So certainly we eat salads warm, right? I throw all my greens on the grill and squeeze a little fresh citrus over it and maybe throw some grilled corn on there and so on. So salads can be hot, not necessarily cold. Not necessarily leafy greens either, right? Think of a classic pasta salad. That might have no greens in it whatsoever. Just pasta, olives, cheese, vegetables, right? Salads can also have proteins in them like meat, chicken, beef, shrimp. So now really, what is a salad? It can be fresh or it can be cooked. It can be hot. It can be cold. It can be vegetarian. It can be vegan. It can have meat in it. It's like any food could almost fall into the category of a salad when you're just putting some ingredients together. I guess what I would say then, let's think bright, fresh flavors. That's what I would think of with salad. And for our summertime entertaining, we're going to think cold, right? So any cooking we might have to do for the salad, we're going to do in advance. When I have guests over or I'm entertaining outside in the summertime, the first thing I always think is fruit salad. It's refreshing, right? It's colorful. It keeps everyone hydrated, and even kids love it, right? So instead of doing the classic sort of chopping up all your fruit and tossing it in a bowl, think differently, right? Plan it out a little bit better. Get yourself a nice platter, a nice big oval platter. A white platter is best because it'll show off the colors of the fruit. Cut your fruit in large pieces. Think beautiful wedges of watermelon. Make it easy. Remove the rind, right? But you can still cut nice wedges of watermelon, just shaving the rind off, and have beautiful little pink triangles of watermelon. Take a whole pineapple, right? Cut off the top and bottom. Shave the sides down. Cut it in half. Cut it in quarters. Remove the core. Take nice large slices of that pineapple. Lay that out next to your watermelon, right? Forget about bunches of grapes, and then people can't pick, and they pick one single grape, and then it leaves, you know, the whole kind of funny cluster there, and nobody knows what to do with it. Put some fresh blueberries on there instead, right? Maybe a handful of strawberries. Be creative. Use your eye, right? Just kind of lay it all out. Let it kind of flow on a big platter. Instead of mixing it all together where your strawberries bleed onto your pineapple and turn it red, keep everything sort of separate so you can enjoy the beautiful colors. And this way, I don't like pineapple. Well, don't take any pineapple, right? They don't have to pick through their bowl and remove the pineapple. They can just go to the other side of the platter that maybe has some fresh melons or some papaya. Think fruits that are colorful, right? Of course, intense splashes of color comes from things like berries and kiwis, and we can get beautiful, interesting shapes from fruits like star fruit. But also think of different colored melons, right? From a watermelon to a cantaloupe to a honeydew. very different colors, right? Papaya, which has sort of a beautiful pinkness about it. Pineapple, which is sort of a beautiful golden yellow. Stay away from fruits like pears, apples, peaches, bananas. These are fruits that discolor as they're sitting out on the platter outside. And you want to avoid that a little bit. It'll distract from your fruit platter. That's all you need to do. Just lay everything out beautifully on a platter. Put a fork or a pair of tongs there. Let people sort of have at it, right? I think of when I want a green salad or I want vegetables, avoid leafy greens, because what does a leafy green salad do outside on the back deck while you're in the pool? It wilts and wilts and wilts and gets watery and turns to mush. It loses its texture. It loses its appeal, right? Save the tossed salad for the dining room. You want to get some veggies out there? Think about a Greek salad. Now, to me, a classic Greek salad has no greens. It has no leafy greens, right? I'm going to take, again, a nice platter. I'm going to slice out some heirloom tomatoes. I'm going to slice off some beautiful garden cucumbers, lay them next to that. I'm going to do a nice mixture of red and green bell peppers cut into circles right next to that. Sprinkle some Kalamata olives in there. Get some beautiful garden scallions. Leave them whole. Just trim maybe the top rough edge of the green off and the little root off the bottom. Rinse, of course, rinse all your vegetables always, and lay those beautiful scallions out in a big bunch. So you've got the tomatoes, the cucumbers, the peppers, the scallions. Have some fun. You can toss anything in there you want, really. For a Greek salad, I'd kind of leave it that simply. Some Kalamata olives, crumble some feta cheese, a little bit of lemon juice and olive oil over it. Perfect. Maybe a little sprinkle of fresh or dried oregano. You've got a wonderful vegetable salad. Or slaws. Slaws are a great way to bring vegetables to the summertime table, right? Almost anything can be turned into a slaw. And you can always start with a classic base of cabbage and then think about adding different flavors and textures. Kind of go outside the box a little bit, right? So if I'm making a more basic slaw, I may start with cabbage, but then I'm going to add things like carrots for color and sweetness. I might add basil for some bold flavors. If I'm sort of doing something on the grill and I want little Tex-Mex kind of flavors, I might add some cilantro and jalapenos. Another thing I like to add to slaws are unripe tart fruits like green mangoes, papayas, Granny Smith apples. Cut these things up in thin slices. Toss them right in with your slaw. Perfect. Celeriac, something that will add some creamy crunchiness. It's a vegetable that most people don't know here in the U.S. Sometimes called celery root. You'll see it in the supermarket. Sort of a big brown, knobby-looking thing. Peel it up. Cut it in thin slices. Toss that into your slaw. Perfect. I also love daikon, right? The Japanese radish brings in some spiciness. Forget about mayonnaise, right? Think a little bit healthier. It's summertime, lighter, fresher. Squeeze a little fresh citrus, a little olive oil over everything. Toss it all together. Slaws you want to make fresh. If you make them the day before in the refrigerator, you'll get a nice melding of flavors. You'll lose a little bit of the texture. I like to make my slaws a couple hours before I'm going to eat them. They're just perfect. Great summertime entertaining. Meat proteins. Think of what are we going to have with our salads, right? Barbecue chicken, always classic. The great things about barbecue chicken is who doesn't love leftover barbecue chicken, right? Put your chicken on the grill the day before, earlier that morning. Lather it up with a great barbecue sauce so it stays nice and moist, right? Cool it down to room temperature, put it in the refrigerator if you've done it the day before, and serve that with some of your salads. I also love things like skirt steak, or also known as churrasco, right? This is also something you can do the day before or even an hour or two before you sit down. Grill your steak and then chill it. Keep it a nice medium rare on the inside. Let it cool down, put it in the refrigerator, chill it up nicely, and you can cut nice thin slices on an angle and just kind of lay it out, huh? How about throwing some grilled onion rings on there, right? Instead of deep-fried onion rings, think grilled onion rings. You take your steak off the grill, throw some marinated onions on there, big, thick slabs, a little salt and pepper. Chill those down also. Serve it over your steak. So you've got some nice cold steak. You've got some barbecued chicken. You can even grill some salmon in advance. I love to grill salmon and kind of flake it with some white beans. And I'll mix in lots of tomatoes and fresh basil and a little bit of garlic, right? So you've got some great entree salads ideas also. Summertime's about entertaining. It's about being outside. Keep that in mind. Keep it fresh. Keep it simple. You're listening to World Travel and Dining with Chef Michael Glotz on the World Travel and Dining channel on the Global American Broadcasting Network. One of the many ways you can listen on Saturday mornings from 7 to 9 a.m. is on the web. Go to gabsatellite.com.